Welcome to the Waking Up the Workplace interview series. Welcome to our regular listeners and maybe some new listeners as well. The purpose of the series is to explore the cutting edge of conscious business. And the question that's really at the heart of our inquiry is, what if we saw business not only as a means for trade and profit, but as a vehicle for transforming how we live and work together? So that's definitely one of the questions that we'll be exploring today with Will Torbert, who I'll introduce in a second. My name is Diederik Jansen, and I'm here today with my colleagues and friends, Ewan, who's kind of producing this conversation today, as he likes to call it, which actually means he's not in the conversation and he's sitting behind a laptop. And then also here with me is Jeroen, who is in the conversation. How are you doing, Jeroen?
I'm doing very well. I'm really looking forward to this call. I must say, I'm actually always really looking forward to these calls, but I'm really impressed with Action Inquiry, and I just really love it, and I'm dying to get into the interview, so it's going to be great.
Cool. So Jeroen was already referencing it, Action Inquiry. It's the work of professor, or actually emeritus professor, if that's right, of leadership at the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, Bill Torbert, who's also served as the graduate dean of the school and director of the PhD program in organizational transformation. He's also consulted widely internationally and serves still, I think, but he'll be able to tell us that in a second, as director of research for Hart Hill Consulting in the UK. And he's written a lot of books. Probably the most well-known, definitely by us, is called Action Inquiry, The Secret of Timely and Transforming Leadership. Before retiring, he also taught at Yale and Harvard, and then continued to work for a long time at Boston College. So we're really glad to have you on the call today, Bill. How are you?
Great to be here. Glad to be with you.
Great. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about where you are in the world, so people get a sense of, you know, who's on the phone.
You want me to say?
Well,
you mean literally, I'm in Boston. I'm in Newton, in my home, at my dining room table. Is that what you had in mind?
That's exactly what I had in mind. Actually, that paints a pretty clear picture. You know, I can also paint you a picture of where we are. People will be familiar with it if they've been listening regularly to our calls, because we're always in the same place. But it's called Duinlust. It's a beautiful mansion near Haarlem, outside of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. Well, we're in a different room today, so that's different. But otherwise, it's the same beautiful space, and the sun is just setting. It's about 8 p.m. here now, and we're looking out over the woods, and we've all taken our shoes off, so we're pretty comfy and ready for the call. So that's where we are.
Great. I've got my slippers on.
Right. Very good. So for the call today, we'll just have about 60 minutes of three-way conversation between yourself and Jeroen and me. And then we'll follow up with maybe some 20 to 30 minutes of Q&A, where people listening in can either throw up their questions through the Internet, on Facebook, actually, which I'll talk about in a second. Or if they're on the phone, then you'll be able to actually join us live and ask your question to Bill live. But that's happening at the end of this call. So for those of you who already want to maybe post some of your questions or insights as we go, I'll just let you know how to do that. If you're looking at the Instant Teleseminar screen, you'll find a link on the left which says Facebook page. Click here. So when you do that, it takes you to the Waking Up the Workplace Facebook page. You can go ahead and write something. If you're there for the first time, you'll need to like the page. Maybe you can actually do it now. So if you click on the link to the Facebook page and go there, maybe even click the like button, then you'll be able to share something. It would be nice to hear where you're listening in from, so who you are and where you're listening in from, because we have quite an international crowd, and it'd be nice to see where people are listening in from today. So you can do that on Facebook. And if you have any questions as we go, just put them on, and we'll be looking at those, and you get a chance to ask those at the end. But I suggest that we get going with our dialogue. Are you about ready to dive in, Bill?
Yep, absolutely.
Awesome. So the first question that we always ask people is, what is work to you?
Well, I don't think I have any extraordinarily unique definition of it. First of all, it's something that you, in a sense, discipline yourself to do in a way, whether you like it or not. Although, of course, broadly speaking, it's wonderful if one can like it and if it feels more like play. But it, it even if it is play, even if one thinks of oneself as a pure artist, and it's all, in a sense, voluntary, it is important not just to play whenever one wants to, but to actually work at what one is creating. I've learned that from the artists who work every single day. And now that I've retired, I've become an artist. Really, in the end, an artist of one's days. But it still means doing disciplined work. That it extends you beyond yourself, because for it to ever become recognized as work, it has to have some value for somebody else. So in a sense, you have to get beyond your own ego a little bit to truly work and to work well and create something of value. But it's also, of course, and so in that very way, it's already developmental. There are lots of reasons why one's work can improve if one develops to later action logics, and maybe we'll talk about that as we go.
I'm sure we will. Yeah, I'm wondering, because you just said in the prep before we went into the call that you retired 3 years ago, and I'm wondering, like, how has that changed, you know, answering this question of what is work?
Well, I stopped doing the work I was doing in more ways even than I had planned at the time. I had vowed not to continue doing scholarly writing. I would not start anything new and just finish a few things, and that's all done. That's very satisfying, to be able to consider one's career completed. Now I can comment on my own work, maybe, although I won't do it in an academic work. So the work changed, and at first, of course, that meant I was being more exploratory as to just what the work would be. I imagined that I was going to try to write some different kind of non-academic book that would finally get my message out to a few more people, since I'd written 11 books, and people mostly just know the last one, that Action Inquiry book. So my career actually died years ago. I finally caught up with it and let it go. But now I really am working on a book, and not just fooling around with it, working every day. So that's one way, and it's a different kind of book. It's autobiographical in nature and less formal, and it includes the voice of many other people, of my close friends, not always with complimentary comments about me, I'm afraid. So I'm doing that, and I have created alchemist work parties, work party being meant to emphasize that it isn't all work, it's work and play, and for people who see their life as more voluntary and who are interested in creating transformative alchemy together. So we have three-day events from time to time, but that's mostly also to re-enliven my early friendships, and so about half of the people who come are my own oldest friends. I even got my brother to come. So trying to create a more active friendship circle, a kind of my last community of inquiry in my life that hopefully will take me to the moment of death if I'm very lucky, and I'll be able to die more intentionally than we usually do in this culture with my friends helping.
Wow. I'm also wondering, Bill, because you just mentioned that you consider your career completed, and so you're, you know, particularly, I guess, when you're writing your autobiography, you know, in a great place for kind of stepping back and looking at the whole of it. And that makes me wonder, if you do that, what do you find is the kind of single driving question behind all of the work that you've done?
Gee, that's not fair. That's an awfully hard question.
No, in the spirit of inquiry, there's no reason why you need to answer it in 2 seconds. You can take three or four.
Well, gee, that's a good, really good question. The single driving question. I suppose one could say, I mean, that it's fairly simply how to live a good life, and trying to get clear what the foremost elements of a good life are, and what it would mean, you know, to apply the knowledge to my own life. In other words, I've always been interested not in at a distance third-person knowledge for its own sake, but in knowledge that in the knowledge that only I can create about myself. Nobody else really knows what's going on inside me and whether I'm trying to learn or not at this moment or another moment. And so how do I learn, you know, what myself really wants in life? And then, you know, how do you find out how to create the relationships that you would like to create? Most of us would like to have strong, thriving love relationships, and yet it seems that almost all human beings struggle like fiends to try to develop such a relationship. Why is it so hard for us to create the loving relationships most of us would like to have? That depends on second-person knowledge or second-person inquiry. Can we find out what one another really wants? And how those two relate then to broader, larger numbers, third-person inquiry. So, you know, and one of the things I figured out really early was that although money is obviously a key good in life, it is, in my way of ranking it, only the fourth most important thing. Good work is more important than good money, and good friends are more important than good work, and good questions are the most important of all. So in my theology, inquiry is the highest value, which I think is the only political value that doesn't become authoritarian by practice, unless, of course, it's being mispracticed.
Well, if the single driving question behind all of your work and what you're describing now in the highest level is good questions, I would love to hear some of the best questions you have found in your life.
Right. Well, yeah, it's a strange thing. You research and you try to learn, and in this way of understanding the world, you don't end up with final answers. In a way, you end up with final questions. So again, these questions, what constitutes good money for me, because good money will be different for different people, I figured out that I've tended to make about a fifth as much money as most of my good friends in the last 30 years. My own estimate is I may be a little happier than they are on average. My brother makes about a fifth as much money as I do, and as far as I can tell, he's a little happier than I am. So, and as we know from recent research, the super rich are riven by anxiety. So, money, what is the right amount of money? You know, and I say the right amount of money is the amount that makes me pay the least attention to earning money. So if you can have good work that earns you good money, then you're in great shape. So you know, and what is good work for each person? It'll be obviously be different for each of us. How do we learn what good work is for us? And similarly with friends, what are good friends? In my world of development and transformation, the best friends are the ones that help you die and get born again. For a while, my title for my autobiography was going to be Born Again and Again and Again.
Could you maybe say a bit about the reasoning behind that title?
Well, you know, in a sense, because it's about development, and each developmental transformation is, in a sense, being born again. So instead of being ambitious just to be born again once in my life, I've been ambitious to be born again and again. I had a spiritual teacher who I experienced, without fully understanding it, going through a major personal transformation in his 70s. And that was one of the most dignified processes I ever experienced. Nobody would ever have known if he didn't go through that transformation, and yet something in him was provoking him not to sit pretty, but to struggle. So that's what it's meant to refer to. Came to sound a little pretentious after a while, so I gave it and its subtitle up, but it's a good description of what I'm trying to write about. What are the very best questions, if we're talking about good questions? Well, as I've already said, I think one of them is what kind of knowledge do we want? And traditional Western scientific knowledge seems to me to be a relatively low form of knowledge. I don't want to denigrate it absolutely by any means, because it's been the great advance of the last 500 years. But it only thrives when it's purely impersonal, and that kind of knowledge is precisely what we can't generalize to our own personal lives. So if we want to go beyond generalizing statistically and find knowledge that's truly directly relevant to this moment in one's life, one has to go in a different direction than that goes beyond Western science as we know it to this time. And in particular, that doesn't divide action from inquiry the way that we have tended to do these many years, saying that that the most valid inquiry is the most detached inquiry, and that all action is filled with bias, and so you can't gain valid knowledge if you're in the midst of practice. If that's true, then none of us can really learn anything valuable for our own lives. So I think we're quite confused about that question. What is true love? I think true love is mutual and mutually transforming. It doesn't completely leave people alone. It rather challenges them. And of course, not everybody wants to be challenged all the time. So it's very difficult to figure out what true love is. What is timely action? That's a question that can never be answered once and for all, because the context is constantly shifting. So what kind of knowledge can tell me what kind of action is timely now?
Yeah, I'm wondering, Bill, you were just saying about action and inquiry being separated, and one of the things that struck me while reading your book, I was wondering whether there was maybe also a parallel between, you know, how action and inquiry have historically been separated with one of the core themes of this series, conscious business, where I was wondering whether something similar might be going on. But before we go there, I was wondering what happens, you know, when you separate action from inquiry. Because I think a big part of the book was about, rather than separating them or even alternating them, to interweave them in the present moment. So I'd like to go there in a second, but actually, as context, what happens when you don't?
Well, of course, it makes if we refer to the workplace, it makes people want to do their work with the least possible inquiry, and that leads people to have a tendency to reject change, especially what I call double loop change. I mean, it turns out that in the early developmental action logics, you know, that I call opportunist, diplomat, expert, which constitutes most people, even most adults, there's a very, very ambivalent relationship to learning anything from present action. There's a tendency to push away new learning, to try to save face, to believe that only a greater master of one's own discipline might be able to give one a little bit of feedback. And even at this achiever action logic, the interest is only in single loop learning. I mean, okay, I didn't get what I wanted there. I didn't reach the goal. What do I need to do differently to get to that goal? But larger learning, when two organizations merge and each has a different culture, or on an individual level, when I meet somebody from a different social class or culture, they're often working out of a different set of assumptions than I am. And my first reaction is I don't like it because it is different and it feels unfamiliar and I don't feel comfortable. I feel out of sorts, out of my region of competence. And so it's only after the achiever, which very few people move beyond, that people begin asking questions that permit them to form personally and that permit the business to transform. So, you know, one of our studies years ago that's mentioned in that book, we spent a total of nearly a decade trying to influence companies and generate transformation that their CEOs said they wanted. But it turned out that only the CEOs who had reached beyond the achiever level to the strategist action logic were successful in generating transformation. The only exceptions were when they had a consultant who was at an action logic even beyond strategist, alchemist. So in general, it requires a late post-conventional action logic, a CEO who has an action logic of that kind to generate successful organizational transformation. And
wow.
That becomes more and more frequently necessary in today's world.
Because that's a pretty strong research finding and totally relevant, I think, to the workplaces that so many of us find ourselves in, particularly today where kind of reorganizations or restructurings or something that happens not just every couple of years, but just almost every couple of months.
Uh-huh.
So getting that right is pretty important. But I'm also aware that Jeroen and myself have been kind of studying your work for a long time and have been going over it again today. So we're pretty familiar with what you're saying about action logics and the different kinds of action logics that you're mentioning. I'm wondering for those of us, or for those people listening in that don't know them so well, could you just, kind of give us an overview of what that's about?
And maybe add to that a bit, what is action inquiry?
Well, first of all, the notion of these developmental action logics are that we all go through them in a certain sequence. The reason for that is that each one has a set of assumptions, and to get outside of that action logic, you need to question the assumptions. The first set of assumptions is that more or less might makes right, a kind of Hobbesian political philosophy view of the world that says, the way the world works is through unilateral force and power. And, of course, there's enormous amounts of evidence to support that. The Middle East dictators are at this very moment in the last gasp of trying that mode as the most powerful of all modes. But as we all know, people don't like you too much if you are constantly forcing them to do things. And so some people eventually realize that the assumption that everybody has to be hostile to everybody else is a limiting assumption, and that that permits people to move from this, what I call, opportunist stage to a diplomat stage, where you realize that for longer term relationships and getting what you want from other people, it's helpful if you set up a more reciprocal relationship. The trouble is that the diplomat can't distinguish his own identity very well from the people that he or she is trying to please. And so it turns out that that person also gets in a bunch of conflicts because he can't please everybody. And so out of questioning whether there isn't a better resolution, a better way of finding true knowledge and good action, people move to the expert stage, where they become convinced that there is expert knowledge that can help you do things better, and that that's more reliable than what people say they'd like you to do, or than merely doing things because people are forcing you to. But even they aren't really interested in getting it right with other people who may not agree with them. They tend not to be very good team players. And the achiever begins to realize that, yeah, you've got to coordinate people who have different fundamental approaches to the world. You can't have everybody agreeing on absolutely everything every time. So there's some kind of give and take and flexibility between plans and actions and between me and you. And we need some feedback from the environment. Even if we don't agree with those damn customers, we'd better listen to them, or else we're not going to succeed in marketing our product. And then after that achiever, comes those later action logics, individualist, strategist, alchemist, that we think of as being adult development action logics. You know, adult development was only, didn't exist when I first created this theory. I mean, there wasn't the phrase adult development. There was Piaget's child development. So in a way, we're just beginning to explore the notion that there are as many possible further developmental stages for adults as there were for children. And in the later stages, you're going beyond seeking generally valid knowledge to seeking knowledge that's more and more particularly appropriate to these people at this time, at this moment. And we're going beyond single-loop feedback to cultivating the possibility of giving and accepting double-loop feedback, which challenges the box we're in when everybody uses the cliche, thinking out of the box, which of course is a cliche and therefore is thinking in the box, the phrase itself, but nonetheless, real thinking out of the box begins to occur at the post-conventional action logics, and that's useful for transforming oneself and organizations. I don't know if you want to pursue the question further and get into more specifics about those later action logics.
I love how you just described the different assumptions that you have to get out of to go to the next level of action logic. So maybe you can explain a bit about that in the higher levels of the action logics as well.
Sure. Good way to go about it again. Up through the achiever action logic, everybody is making the assumption that the world they see is the real world, and that people who don't agree with them are, stupid in one way or another, that they don't have their head screwed on right. And what the individualist begins to realize is that everybody has a frame. These are all frames, each of these action logics. They're a set of assumptions that we're operating on. And so suddenly the world becomes much more complex because you realize that you're dealing with people, all of whom have different frames, and that there's no way of proving that a frame is true. you can prove in an individual circumstance, you know, you can find evidence that supports every single one of these frames. That's why they all continue to exist so happily. They all have plenty of confirming evidence. But each one tends to think it's got all of the important evidence, and the individualist for the first time realizes that that's not so, and that as a result, there's a sense in which everything is relative. It's the postmodern position. Now that we're globalizing, it's hard for people to remain, especially people who travel or people who become professional, to remain encapsulated and really truly believe their way is the only way. But nevertheless, most of us struggle to do that. The problem for the individualist, I mean, it's wonderful in terms of getting to know oneself and other people better. One's suddenly really interested in these differences. The big shift from achiever to relativist or individualist is the shift from preferring similarity to preferring difference. So all the late action logics like difference. It's interesting to relate to it. It provides the possibility of challenging your own assumptions. The early action logics don't like that. When people get upset that a developmental theory is hierarchical and then it's assumed that makes it elitist, I often point out to people that it's the early action logics that like to act hierarchically and who discriminate against people who are different. The later action logics and who use unilateral power, the later action logics become more and more interested in the possibility of mutual power, which is not even in political scientists' definition. I mean, nowadays we hear about soft power and smart power. We're beginning to hear about a different kind of power than force, but nobody actually talks about mutual power, because even when we're talking about smart power and soft power, we're talking about getting our way a different way than through hard power and weapons. Mutually, you know, my understanding is that you cannot force transformation. It has to be volunteered for by the person or the team or the organization transforming, as well as potentially instigated either by contextual developments or by leadership interventions of various sorts. So the later action logics are more interested in those. The individualist has trouble figuring out how decisions are going to be made, because it seems that everybody has to agree. There's no basis for forcing people. What the strategist begins to realize is that, yes, it's possible to generate shared visions and test one another's commitments to them and develop trust and confront mistrust in such a way that you can get democratic or a collaborative inquiry that can generate organizational structures. They don't just have to be imposed by a single superior class on all the other people in an organization or a community. So that's the strategist begins to recognize how you can really make collective decisions. But the strategist I sometimes call the tragic action logic because it still has a certain heroic leadership quality to it. It still has a belief that complex rationality can deliver us the decisions we need. And the movement to alchemist is the recognition that there's an enormous universe beyond our wildest thoughts and very close to home, that there's a different kind of attention than thinking attention. There's a kind of attention that could watch my thinking and my body and my feelings all at the same time as I'm in action with you right now. And cultivating that quality of attention as an individual or as a community of inquiry could be very much to be desired by some people. For other people, one has to want to volunteer for that kind of development. But the movement from strategist to alchemist is a spiritual movement. It's the final supplanting of the ego by a higher energy. doesn't mean the ego absolutely disappears, but it becomes more of a variable and less of an absolute. So that's a little bit on the changes of assumptions at the later action logics.
Does that mean that, in a way, human destiny is spiritual?
Well, does it mean human destiny is spiritual? Well, it means that one can ask oneself, you know, when you say, if you ask yourself, where does everything come from? In a way, that's what the religious systems are supposed to answer. And if you get some help and you start looking at yourself, you realize that, in a sense, the source of everything you know is your attention. I mean, but we don't know what our attention is. And we know the one thing we can verify pretty quickly is that we're not in control of it very well. We may be able to control our thought and our body and our feelings at various moments, and those are hard to control, partly because our attention is not really unified. We go to bed very excited about one thing, and we wake up the next morning, you know, not able even to remember what it was we were so excited about. I mean, there's some odd way in which the attention works that we don't know very much about. So if you want to equate the attention with the spiritual, which I think makes some sense, yes, human destiny, human destiny is either to kill ourselves off, and we're working hard on that these two centuries with our nuclear weapons and our ecological disasters and our inability to find a way of working more comfortably in the context of the whole planet. But if we don't kill ourselves off, then maybe our destiny is spiritual.
And I'm asking it as well because I think I hear people more talk about this, but I mean, what I get from how you've come to these action logics is actually through research.
Yep, right. Real empirical research, not just reading big theories and working with the huge theories, but yep, day to day empirical research.
Well, so it's interesting if. You know, if that's actually a scientific answer.
Well, of course, the science upon which it's based can always be challenged, the numbers and so forth and so on, but we have done an enormous amount of work in the nitty-gritty of trying to validate the measure that that we've developed, the leadership development profile, and still, for example, the study I mentioned earlier about the CEOs who succeeded in creating organizational transformation, many of my fellow social scientists say, well, that's just a 10-organization study. That's a small number study. The statistics don't mean very much in a case like that, which is unfortunately totally wrong for people. It's funny how the statisticians don't understand statistics. Because the fact is that the study found results at the 0.01 level of probability. That 0.01 level of probability is just as good with a small number as with a large number of cases. You can only get that level of probability in a small number of cases if there's a very, very high correlation between your independent variable and your dependent variable. That in turn means that you've explained a lot of the variance with your hypothesis. So when we correlated, we added the action logic of the CEO and the action logic of the lead consultant together, and we then had a separate measure of organizational transformation with very high reliability among the three scorers, and once we put the correlation together, it accounted for 59% of the variance. Most social science findings account for about 5% of the variance. But they have such huge samples that they end up being, yes, it's true, there really is a relationship, but it's a very small relationship. Whereas what we found is, yes, it's true, there's a relationship between the individual's action logic and the organizational outcome, and it's a huge relationship. It makes more than half of the difference. So it's not that it shouldn't be retested and tested in other circumstances, but the reason why it makes such a big difference is because what the measure is measuring is the degree of inquiry that the leader is engaged in the situation. So a strategist, an individualist or strategist or alchemist is engaged in more here and now inquiry in the midst of meetings, in the midst of encounters with people. What should I say next? What's the important thing here? What is the single question driving your work? And the consultant raises it with the CEO, and the CEO is willing to raise that kind of question with their team members. And so what's happening is that this action inquiry process is much more intense in companies where there are people that are playing leadership roles with later action logics.
I was wondering about that, Bill. About, we were talking about the action logics, and the other big piece that you're writing about in the book titled Action Inquiry is action inquiry. So I was wondering how they're related, but I think you're answering this question now. If I'm correct, you're saying that as you develop through these action logics, as you develop as an adult, the degree of inquiry that you engage in the moment increases. Is that right?
That's right, if one is moving through the action logics, yes.
So, we've laid some of the groundwork around these action logics. Can you maybe say a bit more about action inquiry? Like, what is it?
It is simply the process of trying to figure out what to do in any situation. And so it's helpful in figuring out what to do to have a feeling for what one's own capacities are, namely what my action logic is, and what the other people I'm working with most closely on my team, and what the current organizational action logic is, because it's true in this theory that both on an individual level and a collective level, one moves back and forth between action logics that are more agentic and action logics that are more communitarian, you might say, more other-focused. If an organization has been centralized for some period of time, it's almost certain that its next move needs to be in a more decentralized direction. And vice versa, if the organization has been decentralized for quite a long time, it's very likely it needs to move towards centralization. So neither centralization nor decentralization is good in itself. If one looks at the organization from a developmental point of view, one may be able to begin deducing what sort of action will be most useful to it in its next phase. And in my consulting and in my leadership roles, that is one of the things I look at. So this is not merely an individual developmental theory, and that's one of the reasons why I think it's quite useful, is because there's also a theory of organizational development, and likewise, there's also a theory of scientific development. One can look at science as being done at different action logic levels by different scientists. So how do you do action inquiry? Well, obviously you have to cultivate, first of all, a quality of attention in yourself that is actually not just being carried along by events, but where there is a quality of observing oneself and observing the situation, observing the team one is working with, not just working with ideas and flip charts and presentations, but actually trying to understand the group dynamic and what's keeping this team from working more effectively and more transformationally. So it's asking those kinds of questions, you know, or more personally in a relationship. You know, why are my wife and I fighting about the same thing again? How is it that we each fight? Is there a way I could fight differently this time? Can I bear to try it?
So I'm wondering, listening to that, like, how is that different, being more observant in the sense of things happening out there and working with presentations and data, et cetera, and becoming more observant or aware of what's happening, for example, in the relationship? But is that a different kind of data?
Not entirely. Obviously, the data in present time in this relationship is what we'd call clinical qualitative data. I mean, of course, I may see things that remind me of the more impersonal quantitative data findings. If I go and I am watching managers at work, we did a study years ago in which we found a strong correlation between later action logic managers were much more likely when they delegated to delegate with inquiry. They wouldn't just say, go do this. They'd say, look, we're trying to get this done, so I think what you ought to do is that. Let me know once you've finished or if you see a problem with doing that. So you delegate the other person, but you also empower them to raise questions about the situation. Also, early stage managers tended to try to solve problems as they arose, whereas later action logic managers aggregated problems and tried to see relationships among problems, and then, you know, would make a decision that affected a number of problems at once. So, you know, if I see that when I'm consulting in a particular person, I immediately begin hypothesizing from that clinical data to the quantitative data we already have. But of course, the main issue with real-time data is that you yourself are a player in the situation, and how can you, and there are always issues of power and trust, so how can you create a relationship where there may be quite a lot of distrust in which, you know, the ultimate difficult organizational conversation is about power. That's the hidden process that runs everything, you know. So talking back to your manager is well known to be, you know, the most risky thing you could do. So how can you talk to a superior and give them news they don't want to hear, which is, you know, in the good of the larger workplace, perhaps, or at least that's your hypothesis. So you're not only asking yourself questions in the real-time setting, you're adjusting your own behavior moment by moment as you go. And, of course, the power and the mistrust in the situation affect you too.
To make it concrete, could you maybe give an example of how you would talk to your superior in a way from different action logics?
Well, I'm not sure if this will cover it, but the first instance that springs into my mind is an organization I was involved in for a long time, which I won't say what it was, in which in a succession of chief executive, the decision was to promote two people to a co-CEO role. And this seemed like a very good decision for a number of reasons, including the fact that the organization as a whole was a kind of worker-owned organization. So it was a small organization of some 30 people, and most of them, except the newest people, were co-owners already. So the notion of co-leadership was very central, and the notion of working as peers and making decisions together. So to have this exemplified by the two leaders being co-CEOs seemed very appropriate. In addition, they both had different specialties, and there was some tension between them at the outset, but over a period before they were appointed, they actually seemed to have worked through those tensions and be excited about the opportunity. They took over at a very difficult time in history and were under enormous pressures immediately. They had been scored as late achievers on the leadership development profile, which should be a little short of the capacity really needed to do this well. But not wanting to be captive to my own system, I thought that they had a good chance, that yes, it might be transforming for them. I had not in advance known what a difficult situation they would actually be in. And as it turned out, because it was a new arrangement, they were asked to consult the chairman of the board if they had any differences between themselves before they made those differences public in the company in any way. You know, we were very concerned that their capacity to collaborate was still somewhat limited, and so we wanted them to work it through with the board chair. Interestingly enough, they had a consultant at the same time who advised them not to talk with the board chair, but rather to resolve it among themselves, and indeed they had a disagreement within about 30 days. But the board chair didn't find out about it until 60 days, and by that time, in the intermediate 30 days, the company had completely divided between these two people, each of whom talked to the people they were closest to, of course, and these two different stories developed in the organization, and people who had worked together for literally years and years became terrific enemies very, very quickly. Loyalties formed, and it was necessary to fire both people and to begin again. So maybe that gives a kind of concrete feeling for the limits of certain action logics. Of course, I don't know for sure if they had both been strategists. Would it have been different? My prediction is yes, it would have been different. They would have understood more the ramifications of beginning to talk with their allies, preferably rather than the whole company and so forth. And I don't think they understood or had an intuitive appreciation for the group dynamics that they were unleashing by their attempt to sort of save face and not bring a conflict between them to the proper authority.
I'm also wondering, Bill, you know, what was maybe limiting them? Like, could that also have to do with, vulnerability? Like, not wanting to be vulnerable, for example, in this case, to your superior or the board chair, and trying to save face in that way?
Well, no, I'm exactly. It is a desire not to be vulnerable. And all later action logic mutual power is also vulnerable power. If I believe a transformation of some sort is necessary, I have to open myself to the possibility that it may be me in the end who needs to transform, even though at the outset I'm seeing it needs to be the organization or the other person or the team. If it isn't possible for me to consider that transformation may be my challenge, then how can I expect them to accept the notion that transformation may be their challenge? But in the early action logics, that kind of vulnerability looks like an unacceptable risk. At the later action logics, it increasingly comes to be seen as a necessary risk, and it's just a question of the degree of your commitment as to who you take that kind of risk with. You certainly don't do it with just anyone. You do it with the people that you care about and the relationship, you know, enough that you would like to go through the struggle of transforming the relationship for it to continue.
So I'm also thinking back to the question that that's at the heart of this series and that I presented at the beginning of the call, which was the question of, you know, if we saw business not just as a means for trade and profit, but as a vehicle for transforming how we live and work together.
Right.
That question is actually not meaningful then to a lot of people.
I think that's true. I think a lot of people would say that exactly in the early action logics would say, ah, that's, you know, intellectual, idealistic fantasizing. You'll never get that, you know.
Well, we do actually get that a lot.
See?
How'd you know?
But, you know, I mean, that was how I came into my adulthood, was with the idea that the workplace was exactly what you're saying, was supposed to be for development. And, you know, my first significant experience, was directing the Yale Upward Bound program at an age when I should never have been doing that, but taking kids from backgrounds of poverty and during the late 60s, when the racial situation in the U.S. was so inflamed, and being a white director of a two-thirds black staff and two-thirds black student program was a difficult place to be in. But the reason I wanted to do it was because I thought we needed to invent new kinds of organizations that helped anyone to develop. We actually did cut New Haven's dropout rate in half and improve our students' reading grade level by six grades. We made some positive differences, but I also learned a great deal about how people don't like to be vulnerable.
I'm wondering how you look at that now, you know, like this question of work or business being a vehicle for transformation.
Well, one way to look at it is through what we have learned from doing thousands of these leadership development profiles at Heart Hill, and if people are interested in the in that instrument, they can go to hearthill.co.uk and look at the website there. But one of the things we have found is that there are very, very few people beyond achiever, even in the most senior ranks of most businesses. To take one large scientific business where we've recently profiled 160 of the senior people, 60% were at the achiever action logic, 20% at the expert action logic, and 20% mostly at individualist and a few at strategist. So even in the senior management, only one out of five had post-conventional capacities. So whereas when we profile people who often have dropped out of business to create small consulting firms, we find that the percentage of individualists jumps radically. So this may be the wrong conclusion, but an obvious inference from that is that people get tired of workplaces that don't have developmental possibilities and leave them to form smaller organizations that are more likely to have a late action logic quality to them. Although very often when we talk to people in those small consultancies, we find that they've recreated the achiever state of mind, even though and wish they hadn't, but you know, don't quite know how to create a truly collaborative process.
Which of course, there aren't a lot of models out there either.
No, that's absolutely right. There certainly aren't.
But what have you seen your whole career, as a consultant? I think, like, what have you seen? You know, what can organizations be like when they're designed from, you know, some of these more inquiring action logics?
I may have missed something there. Was that a question to me?
It was. I'll reframe it. Yeah, I was wondering when you were talking about that you know, people leave workplaces because they don't have any, you know, real room to develop themselves. Mm-hmm. And so they start their own businesses, but then often they recreate the same similar conditions to what they had before. And then, you know, I commented that there aren't a lot of models out there, but I'm wondering whether maybe you've seen some of them or whether you have some thoughts around, you know, what could work be like and what can workplaces look like when they're designed from these higher action logics.
Well, the challenge is, of course, that that the design is only half of it. The other half is the implementation day to day, and it's tremendously easy for people to become cynical about the aspirations of such a business when they see the principles in it seemingly contradict their values, which if any of us looks at any of the others of us, we will see moments when it seems to us that that person is contradicting their values. And the typical, and because we all intuitively know that confronting that kind of contradiction is dangerous, again, especially if those people have some power in the organization, there's a tendency not to talk about it initially. And then the discrepancies, the incongruities between espoused values and enacted values grows larger and larger. People become cynical. And by the time it all gets out, people, you know, have lost their trust and sense of commitment to one another, so it comes out nasty rather than constructive. I mean, obviously, that's not the only way it happens. There are wonderful cases with consultants and leaders with great skill that navigate through some of these initially really fraught conflicts. But there isn't a huge amount of that skill out there in the world yet. So, it's still hard to find. Mostly what I've found is that a particular part of an organization gets excited because one or two people has a high commitment to this kind of thing. And those couple of leaders create a group of young Turks who are excited about working in this new way and do feel a kind of spiritual commitment to it. And then over time, they very often demonstrate that their way of working really works and makes money for the company. But increasingly, it seems mysterious to other people why that's the case, since they seem to be operating in such non-conventional ways. And instead of rewarding them for having done so well, really the rest of the company becomes jealous and tries to kick out the supports from under even successful experiments. So we are, there's a huge struggle between the different action logics. And again, the early action logics don't like difference. So they don't like those later action logic folks sort of at first taste.
You know, so when you go back to the title even of this series, Waking Up the Workplace, which we haven't talked about explicitly, though I think it's what we have been talking about a lot, does it stand any chance? Bill, what do you think?
Well, I think I've now taken the point of view that because the workplace is a contract arena, it's not as likely a place for large-scale transformation as friendship is. And so I'm now going to try to start a revolution from the third age, the people that are, you know, have moved from a focus on their career to a focus on the end of their life, the last third of life, the final act. I think people in that period of their lives could be making a much larger commitment to developmental friendships, and that we will gradually infect the world from the elders toward the youngers. We'll rediscover a role for elders in our society. we'll see.
That actually sounds pretty awesome.
And I just want to say that I think it's great that you've just, you know, found a way, you know, born again to make a developmental impact on the world from a completely new place as well. That's great.
Yeah, right. Well, if a million or even a billion times as many people buy the next book as the other ones, I'll have a tremendous impact.
So when's that due, Bill?
Yeah, the embarrassing question. Well, I promised myself that I will finish a first draft by the end of August, which is somewhat unlikely, but I'm going to stop doing this kind of thing in order to do it. This is the last time I'm talking with you folks.
Well, give us 20 more minutes, Bill.
Okay.
Because actually, I think there's quite a few people who are maybe dying to ask you some questions rather than just Jeroen and myself.
Okay.
Terrific. So I suggest that we transition to Q&A, even though there's so many more things that I'd love to talk about. But let's see what other people are thinking.
Great.
I'll just give a few instructions for people listening in. If you want to ask a question, you know, you've been listening to this conversation and there's this one question that hasn't come up or that you would love to ask. If you're on the phone, we can actually have you join the conversation live and you'll get to ask Bill your question, which is pretty awesome. So if you're on the phone, you dial *2 and that will raise your hand so we can unmute you. And then for those of you that are on the internet, as some of you have already been doing, you can just post your questions on Facebook, and we'll take them from there. So again, if you want to know how to get there, if you're looking at the Instant Teleseminar window, you just click the link that says Facebook page, click here, and that'll take you to our Facebook page. And then once you've liked that page, you'll be able to add your comments and questions there. So Jeroen, you wanna throw a first question at Bill?
Yes, I have a question from Wanda Joseph, and she says, Bill, can you point us to the research on how if this framework of human development plays out across cultures, and particularly for the communalistic cultures?
There hasn't been official formal research using our particular form, leadership development profile. I mean, people from different cultures have very definitely taken it, and increasingly around the world, and Suzanne Cook-Reuter with her similar instrument is also definitely working in multiple languages and cultures. The only formal research I know that was specifically raising this question was Lawrence Kohlberg years ago, about 30 years ago. If you go look up Kohlberg, K-O-H-L-B-E-R-G, I mean, he has a lot of work, and I'm afraid I can't now more closely identify it, but he did discover that the theory and the interview and the staging seemed to work across cultures. The hypothesis one would make is that in more communal cultures, you'd tend to find the more community-oriented action logics stressed more and lived in more by a larger percentage of the population for longer periods of time. So in the States, you would think that the opportunist and the expert and the individualist, which are all highly agentic, individualistic action logics, would be emphasized and people would spend longer in them. And in more collective cultures, you'd expect the diplomat and the achiever and the strategist to be, you know, but that research has not been done on a wide scale.
And there is actually another question following on from that about research. It's from Fiona Hayes, who's asking about the research finding about the level of the CEO being so relevant. And she's asking, does that also work if the person at a strategist level is at one level below the top? So not the top itself, but just below that. And she continues, in the workforce, I'm thinking of the MD of one of the business units is at a strategist level and is gradually transforming his business unit. The divisional CEO has seen this starting to work and is trying to drive the culture change across the division now. but he is at the achiever level. So I guess the question is about, you know, for example, in this case, a strategist doing his transforming work, and then above there's a CEO that's actually at the achiever level.
That is one of the most uncomfortable things in organizational life, is when one works for a superior who is at an earlier action logic. And of course, the strategists are often very good at, not tooting their horn in a way that makes the superior jealous. And I remember working for 18 months with a senior team where two out of seven of the MDs were strategists, but not the CEO. It worked very well, and the strategists were definitely playing the leading roles in terms of transforming the team itself and the business more widely and their parts of the business. But at the end of that time, the larger company, of which this was one of the national divisions, ran into severe economic difficulties, and the CEO got scared by that and became very subordinated to his seniors, and didn't protect the innovations and movement they had made, rescinded things simply because at the wider level they had suggested rescinding them. And the two strategists were both gone within 8 months, and actually the CEO lost his job anyway, partly because his team disintegrated. It's a great question because that's difficult. Now, there have been times when I've seen the MD just simply be able to keep a kind of sense of limits and be very successful in their own area and be viewed as a distinct contributor to the larger group. I once heard an MD say that he had to bring in 50 million pounds a year in order to be able to act at his action logic. He had to bring an achiever bounty and pay it each year to be allowed to be as crazy as he was in most of his work. So that's
That's great. You wouldn't just ask me to once again mention that people who are on the phones can also ask questions, and when you are on the phone, you have to press *2. That way you will raise your hand and we can see that you want to ask a question, and then we can unmute you. In the meantime, there are some other questions on the web. And a question that I have from Marta McAllister is, can you describe your intentionally developmental friendship communities a bit more?
I think we're trying to invent a variety of ways of being in developmental friendships across space and time. I mentioned earlier creating these 3-day alchemist workshops. That's a pretty heavy commitment, of course. We would meet in some beautiful country place that doesn't cost very much. And I don't charge people professionally. We just cover the costs together. I try to get even numbers of men and women. I invite people that I already know well, and then they sometimes suggest other friends, or else out of the developmental work that we do through Heart Hill and so forth, people have taken workshops and so we've begin to get to know each other that way. And the meeting is co-led by everybody. We have three types of events that sort of cycle through. We have community meetings, which is the 12 of us. We have trio meetings, and I consider trios a very important number for developmental work, because there are three couples in a trio, so and of course there's a trio, so there's four relationships that can be examined and looked at and felt into There's always a sort of outside observer for any one of the couples. The trios permit people to go much deeper into their personal relationship to whatever our theme is. And our themes have been things like the end of life, meant in both ways, the purpose and the last moment, or a theme such as transforming power or transforming love. And we're trying to understand what those are, but we're also trying to enact them in the course of the event. And then there's also solo time, so everybody is invited to work on their own art. So usually each morning, afternoon, and evening has one of each of those three types of activity. And we've often had masquerade balls on the last night, which permit people to take on a new character that they've discovered they would like to cultivate. And that can be pretty funny. Also pretty chaotic in the sense that people who've gotten to know one another very well suddenly are meeting a new version of that person. Trio phone calls are also very important in creating different people will create them different ways, but they can have the quality of a Quaker meeting, I would say, where you have silences over the phone where people are really searching for what to talk about and not just, trade news, but really raise their most difficult questions and seek help on them or simply discuss the relationship among the three people.
Mm. It must be great to be part of one of those events.
Yes, and I'm getting old now, so the intent is for everybody else to start throwing these events and invite me, so I don't have to do it. It's starting. There now have been several started by people who have been to one, and they invite their friends and some of us and so forth, but I guess I'll have to publish the book in order to get the whole world to start doing these things.
So if we invite you to Amsterdam, you will come by?
Yes, that's a great way to get me to Amsterdam. We'll do an alchemist work party together.
Oh, that's sweet. We'll organize that. So, in the meantime, somebody has raised his hands, and so I'd like to have a live question. It is Toon Busser from the Netherlands. Toon, I will unmute you now.
Good evening.
Oh. Hello.
Hey. Well, thanks for the call. This is awesome. And Bill, it's very good to hear your voice after reading your book, Action Logic. It's very nice to hear you live. Cool. I have a question, actually a couple of them, but I'll keep it to first one. Action Logic, and especially the levels that you're talking about, is that mainly focused on the senior level of organizations or... can you say something about the, you know, if you look at a stratified organization where several action logics are requisitely in place and how that relates?
Right. In some of the early research on larger samples in different organizations, there was a very strong correlation, actually, even though obviously nobody there knows developmental theory, but between the level in the pyramid and the action logic. So, for example, 80% of the people measured as diplomat were in lower management or supervisory positions. 80% of the people measured as strategist were in senior management, not supervisory level, not middle management, but senior management. So there does seem to be a slight tendency for organizations to somehow recognize that later action logic folks are somehow going to be good in senior management. It may very well be the case that in some cases they become strategists by being put into senior management, just the way that some engineers, when they're made project managers, graduate from expert to achiever. And then you have all those engineers who hate management totally and don't see that it's work at all and just want to go back to doing their engineering, those are the experts that aren't making the transition to Achiever, probably. Yeah. So I guess that I think that's the first answer.
Yes, yes. And how would that, I mean, in a company where, as you're saying, like engineers work or doctors, medical, you know, medical professionals, is there like a minimum or at least a preferred minimum stage of development for, you know, a company like working with engineers or working with, you know, highly educated professionals?
Well, first of all, we have plenty of data that supports the notion that the first boss that people like is the achiever boss. People hate the diplomat boss because for a variety of reasons. First of all, they change their mind every time another person talks to them. So even though you did persuade them your way was best, by the time you get to the meeting, somebody else saw them, and they're now spouting what the other person said. The diplomat also tries to avoid all conflict in the team meeting and between the team and senior management, so they don't protect the team and they don't advocate for the team. I'm generalizing wildly here, but this is the overwhelming sense of it from both clinical and quantitative results. The experts, on the other hand, are overbearing. They want everybody to work at their pace. There is no value except work. You should always sacrifice your other time for that. And they are, you know, they're nigglers for detail. And so the way in which they drive people and don't permit them to exercise their own competence is really irritating to a lot of people. Whereas on the other hand, the experts as contributors are often very, very valued. So it's the achievers who are the first managers whom people recognize as supporting them, you know, helping them work through to through dilemmas and so forth, rather than simply shouting at them and telling them not to come back till they have the answer or whatever, or doing it for them. So that's a you know, that's a very general statement, but the achiever is, you know, is a good manager in a stable framework. The achiever starts to lose their footing under conditions of transformation. And so there, a later action logic, a person will usually be experienced as a better manager. The individualist will be looking more into opportunities and creating unexpected ways to resolve dilemmas, and the strategist will tend to have an overall perspective on the transformation process, will have a much stronger sense of how different time horizons fit together and what you can put off now and what you need to do today if and how that fits into a whole series of different time horizons for enacting new strategic initiatives.
Hmm. Well, thanks. That's actually, you know, really relevant to a lot of us, I think. At least definitely recognize a lot of that. Thanks also, Tuin, for asking the question. Hmm. I think we have time for maybe one more question before we end our call today. It's a question from Patty Tanji, and she's asking a question that goes to my heart as well. She says, a little disheartening to hear a movement away from organizations in the arena of transformation. Really, the workplace, is it a lost cause?
Well,
particularly, Bill, for people who maybe aren't into their, what did you say, third age. Third age, exactly. But maybe
first
people
of all,
like you know, myself, who are 30 yeah. and have some way to go.
Well, let me say this, that I don't know, I don't think workplace is a lost cause. It's a place where we have to work. So many of us. But if you want to work developmentally in a workplace, I would say the key to learning much and succeeding and feeling sufficiently supported to continue to do it is to create your own mini communities of inquiry. This phrase community of inquiry is absolutely central to me. In other words, all organizations that we've had so far have tended to be based on answers, whether they be religions or businesses or political parties. The phrase community of inquiry was first created by Charles Peirce, the pragmatist philosopher, who was thinking in terms of what scientists do and how they figure out what's objectively true. And of course, it involves a community of scientists. One doesn't work purely alone, and one tests the statistics against other reliable raters and so forth. But I'm interested in the phrase community of inquiry as a living process. So having a trio or a quartet of people, maybe they're all people in your business, probably preferable if they're not in your same group almost, and you may meet once every 3 weeks for an evening or a Saturday morning or something, and you really try to talk together about what you're trying to do in the workplace, and you can start finding tools to help you out, how to role play difficult conversations, and you could try to create an environment where you all trust each other, and that is to work in a little community of inquiry that's self-created over time, I think is really necessary to keep your courage up.
I can definitely speak to that. Having worked in two great trios, one is Realize and the other is Waking Up the Workplace, and I definitely feel that it can have a huge impact to have that kind of community of inquiry, and definitely three is a great number for that as well.
Mm.
So I think in terms of time, we're about ready to start closing, and I always like to ask the three of us on the call for some closing thoughts, just zooming out a little bit from our conversation. Jeroen, can I start with you? Do you have any closing thoughts on our conversation today?
I really enjoyed the immediate depth of you going into the big questions that you know that you are still and have been inquiring into. And it's and all the research and how you've explained the different assumptions that go through the different phases of the action logics, that was very helpful as well.
Mm.
And I just want to thank you for being, trying to be born again and again and again, and just bringing so many different interesting and meaningful insights about adult development into the world, because also like the other speakers that we talked to, that I think last week I mentioned you were a bit of a legend into the developmental arena, and I'm just very happy that that you were born, that you actually did all your work, and I think we'll be enjoying the fruits of that labor for a long, long time. So I just really, really want to thank you for all the work that you've done.
You're very welcome.
Mm. Well, if I can just build on that, my closing thoughts, I really appreciated this conversation. So much in it that I think I'll want to listen to again, which hopefully is possible because we record it and we can listen to it again. One of the things that really struck me is what you were saying about, good money and then good work and good friends, and in a way, at the top of your theology, you said there was good questions, and I love that. And we were just before the call looking up the meaning of the word emeritus, if that's even spelled correctly. But I found out that it means you're kind of a distinguished professor, but also retired.
Right.
And we found that it's a word that's used either for professors or for bishops. So I guess you're also an emeritus bishop in this theology that you mentioned, which is great. And then the last thing, I guess, is there's one thing which I think, if I heard you correctly, I probably disagree with you on, or at least I would be up for kind of a conversation in Amsterdam at some point. Sit down and have a coffee, and I want to continue the conversation about the workplace, you know, being a vehicle for development, because I totally know that it can be, and you know, I'm dedicated to making that happen. But then again, I also really like to kind of be challenged on that, and you definitely, you know, put some seeds for some food for thought in my mind today. So thank you so much for that.
Well, you're really welcome, and you guys create a really enjoyable environment to speak into and have a nice way of you know, being able to host your audience as well. So thanks so much for creating this ongoing situation that you're doing. This is a little community of inquiry.
Mm-hmm. So it is.
Okay.
So do you have any closing thoughts, Bill, or were those actually your closing thoughts?
I think we should count that as my closing thoughts.
Cool.
I think I've had my chance.
Well, you certainly did, and you certainly took it too. So thank you so much for that.
Okay. Well, take care to everybody on the call. Good wishes.
Okay. Thanks, Bill.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Right. So for those of you left on the call, I just want to quickly tell you what's happening next week before we say goodbye as well. Next week we'll be talking to Rand Stegen, who is a seasoned entrepreneur and is now a senior partner of Stegen, which is a management consulting firm specializing in strategy, execution, and leadership development. And with Realize, we're in a similar business, and you know, Stegen is really an example for us of how you can do business. And I really look forward to talking to Rand and getting some of his insight on the cutting edge of conscious business. So you know, be sure to tune into that next week, same time. And I think that's probably it for now. Goodbye, and we'll see you on the blog or on Facebook or next week.
Thank you.
Bye.